Welcome. We'll start this morning with questions. So anyone who has a question may ask it, and I'll incorporate all the answers into the talk.
In adopting and committing to the way of rest and the Great Freedom Teaching, if in the future I do another intensive meditation retreat, and the preliminary practice of that retreat is one-pointed focus on the breath, would that be counterproductive to the teaching, or is it compatible?
During the inquiries yesterday, I had a very powerful experience, a sense of my identity literally just falling off, which was amazing and quite frightening at the same time, because there's just this expansiveness without an edge. At the same time, I know that I've had experiences of synchronicity and of things happening in my life that very much feel things I've asked for or just even thought about have just appeared in front of me, and that they've, and certain things have occurred that have been such strong and obvious lessons, like so ridiculously contrived by something else to teach me something, that I'm trying to kind of match those two, the lack of identity and the sense of identityless love, with this feeling that there is some energy that's actually teaching me personally specific lessons. So
I've occasionally had the experience that being with certain people, I feel that it feels like they're taking my energy and I'm left exhausted. I just wonder if I'm totally resting. Is there any need to try to protect myself against this in any way, or is it best just to remove myself from the person, or anything?
What is the difference between when we talk awareness and consciousness, or states of consciousness that people talk about?
Anyone in particular who talks about such things?
No, I mean like in the yoga practice, in different chakras, different states of consciousness appear. Or people talk about higher states of consciousness. So what is the relationship with awareness and states?
In these experiences of the, so to say, falling off of identity, completely dissolving of identity, and the expansions, there is a question raised. Whose identity is actually falling off? And not what, but who? Who loses identity? Which is actually the same question as, who's looking in the mirror? And this answer, this aspect of awareness, if you will, is completely unclear for me to find the answer to.
Anyone else before we begin?
I'm not sure exactly what I want to ask, but yesterday we were talking about the fact that nothing has an existence. And I find it so hard to grasp. I mean, I can understand that my thought has no existence, but when I talk to my mother, for example, how can I understand that she, for example, has no existence whatsoever, or you, or I asked you once, what do you see when you're talking to us, and you said nothing. So I'm afraid that you would just answer me, rest again. But anyway, I'm asking again.
Who we are is so simple. It's just so totally and completely simple. And, you know, there's nothing to be baffled by. And there's no position to be taken about anything. So the only time we get into trouble, so to speak, is when we take a position That's the only time we start to feel troubled or uncomfortable. And when we take a position, we're chasing after a point of view that's appearing within the all-encompassing peer view of awareness. And that chasing after a point of view is like a dog chasing its tail. It'll never lead anywhere. The dog will never get its tail. So many times, the things that are stated here, which really don't comprise a doctrine, by the way, are understood through points of view and as points of view, rather than as what was actually said. So in the Great Freedom Teaching, what is stated is that nothing that appears, in other words, none of the points of view within the all-encompassing peer view of awareness, not one of those points of view has an independent existence. There isn't a single point of view that has an independent nature. There is not a single point of view that has an independent identity. There is no point of view whatsoever that is substantial in its own right. So that being so, there's nothing to hold to. You could call it the wisdom of non-appearances. Within appearance, non-appearance appears. So you see, these are not two. We're not positing anything like there is no identity. That says that nothing exists. And we're not positing non-existence either. We're saying that we don't hold to either existence or non-existence as being real. That in what appears, nothing can be found to exist in its own right. But then on the other hand, non-existence, we can't really say that nothing exists either, because points of view appear as whatever they are. So that the way this plays itself out in our own life, if we want to get familiar with the true nature of our mind, which is really all we're talking about here, is that if we just relax, that true nature of the mind, awareness, will become more and more obvious. It's only because we've been chasing around like the dog chasing its tail, perhaps, that the points of view seem to be so important, so urgently important. And when we take these points of view to be so urgently important, then the whole world based on points of view gobbles up our whole life and all of our life energy. And then that's all that we see before us, all these points of view, all these thoughts, emotions, and experiences that we take to be real. But you know, what we are is so simple. In order for any thought, emotion, or experience to appear to us, it has to appear via awareness. So there's no way whatsoever to have any thought, emotion, or experience without awareness, including the idea of being somebody or the point of view of being somebody. It would be impossible to have that idea without awareness. And in the Great Freedom Teaching, we don't say that the personal identity does not exist. I have never said that. And I've never said that the personal identity falls away or goes away forever. That isn't what is stated in the Great Freedom Teaching. What is stated is that the personal identity and the lack of a personal identity are not two. That in this appearance of the personal identity, that experience of a personal identity only is due to awareness, so it's inseparable from it. The personal identity itself does not have an independent nature of its own, a nature that it has generated through its own biological mechanism. And this is very important to understand, that personal identity is only due to awareness. Without it, the personal identity isn't. Thus, the personal identity lacks an independent nature. It lacks an existence in its own right. And this isn't a cause for great alarm, where we're saying, oh, where am I? You know, who am I? Where did I go? Or that we have to be afraid of being annihilated. Those are all very grave misunderstandings about the true nature of our being. The true nature of our being is not static. It is not fixed. It doesn't hold to any point of view that appears within awareness. It's entirely impartial in that regard, impartially responsive. Awareness is impartially responsive as all points of view. As it all is all points of view, there is no point of view to which it's partial. So it isn't partial to the point of view that a personal identity exists, and it isn't partial to the point of view that a personal identity does not exist. You see what I'm saying? So then this allows us an absolutely free flow of love, wisdom, and energy in all aspects of our lives, because we greet all of life with complete openness to all experience, with the complete perceptual openness of all experience. And it isn't that there's someone who is completely perceptually open looking at an experience that is something else, as there only is that awareness that is indivisible from the experience itself. Self-knowing awareness is experiencing itself in the experience. Do you see what I'm saying? There isn't a separate perceiver looking at the experience. We learn that there's a separate perceiver, but when we just rest imperturbably in our natural state, repeatedly, and gain stability in that and familiarity with that, we don't have to worry about all these philosophical meanderings of the mind. We really don't. When we just rest, just relax, and allow the natural ease of our being to be as it is, then in that all philosophical questions are answered. And we see how preposterous it is to take a position. And, of course, many of us have read teachings where extreme positions are taken. So a lot of us didn't come up with this thinking on our own. We came up with it because we heard it from other people or we read about it in books. But, indeed, the true nature of being never takes up a position anywhere. There's essentially no position to be taken up. Whatever appears, it's going to go. And there's no way to hold on to it. So why bother to try? Whether it's a great thought or a terrible thought, it's going to go the same route. It comes from basic space. While it's appearing, it's basic space. And when it ceases, it's the basic space of awareness. So why bother about either the good or the bad? When we stop toying with all the points of view that are appearing within our awareness, within the pure view of our awareness, when we stop toying with them as though they are something, then what comes about is a naturally discovered and already present wisdom that we can't possibly tap into as long as we take points of view to have an independent nature. No matter what point of view appears, it matters not. It doesn't have an independent nature. And some of these are very ingrained in us. Some of our beliefs and assumptions, which are just points of view, are very ingrained in us. So, you know, for example, even the highest teaching, no matter what it is, it has no independent nature. It has no independent identity. And to take it as though it does is to kind of step away from what's real. All teachings, no matter what they are pointers, ostensibly, to our true identity. So if we want to know what our true identity is, it's important to know about and take advantage of teachings that can point directly to that in a very practical way. As it already is, there's nothing to effort for, nothing to accomplish. as all points of view have no independent nature, all points of view lead nowhere. They lead absolutely nowhere. So to think, you know, that our thinking is leading somewhere and our emotions and our actions, that's kind of headed off in the wrong direction if what we want to know is our true nature. If we want to know the true nature of our mind awareness, then to continue to pursue points of view as though they lead somewhere is not going to get us familiar with awareness. When we just relax and let all the points of view dance and sing however they will, then it's just a lot easier. You know, it's a lot easier. It's just so much easier. The question about the meditation retreat and following the breath in the meditation retreat, well, the ultimate meditation is to rest imperturbably. And the ultimate meditation that's talked about in the particular tradition you're in is to rest imperturbably. So with many teachings, like, for example, with the Buddha's teachings, there are 84,000 different teachings. So with so many teachings, we wonder, well, how did this come about? You know, how did the Buddha come up with 84,000 teachings? He must have been a very busy man. I can barely get my laundry done and my food cooked every day. Here's somebody coming up with 84,000 teachings. Well, the Buddha, he lived for a long time as an awakened being. In other words, he knew the true nature of his being for 50 years of his life. And one of the most important instructions the Buddha ever gave was the following. He said to everyone, do not write down anything that I say. Why did he say that? Because he was a very wise man. And he could see that if people started writing down what he said, there would be 84,000 interpretations of Buddhism. He was an emanation of compassion, like we all are, an emanation of wisdom and compassion. And this is what the Buddha taught, that everyone is an emanation of wisdom and compassion, that this is our true nature. So the Buddha, because he lived so long, 50 years, and met thousands and thousands of people, way more than 84,000 people, when he would talk to a person, he would just give them whatever they needed, whatever would support them directly. That's what the Buddha did as an emanation of compassion. He didn't try to get every person to do it according to the way he saw it. He saw that some people had a disposition that would be responsive to one way of teaching, and another person would have a disposition that would be responsive to another way of teaching. And so this is very interesting, but his overall foremost instruction was, don't write down anything that I say. And the other thing was to rely on your own experience. But he said, what I have to say is philosophical, but you can test it in your own experience. And that is the only way you can know about it, if you test it in your own experience. So he was doing just what he had done. He had relied on his own experience to get in touch with and gain familiarity with his own nature. And so he suggested that other people do the same thing, knowing that that's really the only way to realize one's true nature. Now, among all of these 84,000 approaches within Buddhism, there's only one where there is the teaching of resting imperturbably, even though this was the Buddha's primary teaching, to rest in equanimity, to rest imperturbably, to rest as awareness. This was the Buddha's primary teaching, and it was the teaching that he gave himself when he sat under the Bodhi tree. When all else had failed him, all these different teachings that he had been participating in, three different teachers he had participated with. When these failed him completely and he was almost dead from having undergone physical austerities, he said, no, you know, none of this is the way. And I'm going to sit down under this tree until I realize. All of his disciples left him and said, so long. You know, you're not going to teach us what we want to hear from you, so we're going to leave now. Then he just sat under the Bodhi tree, dejected, abandoned, and, you know, he had a lot of other feelings too, I'm sure, because he had given up everything. He had abandoned his wife and child. He had abandoned his kingdom and his father, the king, and his mother, the queen, where he was supposed to stick around and become the king. And so he was sitting there with a lot of feelings, just like any human being would have. And then he had gone out to look for an end to suffering. And he still hadn't found it. So he probably had a lot of feelings like, wow, you know, did I do the right thing? Was this the thing to do? Can I really find the cessation of suffering? I've been looking around and I can't find it anywhere. I know that it exists, but I still haven't found it. So he sat down under the Bodhi tree, and what is described about the Buddha there is described in language that was used at that time. So what the Buddha's language and the language that he used at the time, he talked about maras in the Great Freedom Teaching, and he talked about phenomena. Well, in the Great Freedom Teaching, both what are called maras and phenomena by the Buddha are called points of view. So we could say the Buddha just sat there with all his points of view, no matter what they were. All of his thoughts, all of his emotions, all of the experiences from his life. And he rested in equanimity. He rested as equanimity while all of these appeared. He wasn't seduced by any of them. He didn't want to be the dog chasing its tail anymore. He just relaxed and he let all of the points of view be as they are. No matter what they are, no matter what appeared, he just let it all be as it is. And if any of you have ever read the story, you know that he had many points of view that came up. And who knows how long it lasted. Different historians say different lengths of time. But as he sat there, everything visited him, all of his lust, all of the points of view that he had been neutralizing through all of these other practices, they came up and greeted him. But you see, in all the other practices he followed, he had tried to do different things with the points of view. As a prince, he had indulged his points of view. And then he took up the route of replacing his points of view with positive points of view, meritorious activity, and the development of virtue. And then he avoided his points of view. He tried that too. He became celibate and lived in solitude and practiced austerity. So he tried all these different things on his points of view. But lastly, he sat under the Bodhi tree. And in flawless awareness, he saw all that appeared as flawless awareness until to him all was flawless awareness. That's all there is. This timeless awareness that is the essence of everything. And then he described that as Buddha nature. And the word Buddha in Sanskrit means awakened. So he was called Buddha because he was awakened, not because that was his name. And he just said to everyone, the awakened nature is your own nature. It's already within you. And he departed from his background in Hinduism and what was being taught. He said, not only Brahmins can be in touch with the awakened nature and gain familiarity with it, everyone can be. And then he said the most shocking thing of all, even women can be awakened. Can you believe it? What a radical. Well, lots of people thought that he was way out there, you know. Not everyone was seeing him as the great being he has become. And so, you know, what he found in resting under the Bodhi tree is that all points of view are equal and that no point of view leads anywhere. So how could any point of view, like austerities, avoiding points of view, replacing points of view with better points of view, how could any of them lead anywhere? All these things that he had been trying had led nowhere in his own experience. And it was only when he rested in the equanimity of his own being, his awakened nature, that he began to see that everything that appeared was equal. And he didn't just have lovely things appear. In fact, the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree is about all the negative states that appeared. He was overpowered with all kinds of negative states. And in a lot of what's written, it's portrayed as demons. So it sounds like there were demons, actual demons that appeared. Mara was appearing in all these illusory forms, and he just sat there. But a way we can talk about it in contemporary language that everyone can understand is just to say that all of these points of view appeared within the all-encompassing pure view of the Buddha's awareness. And as he rested imperturbably, then more and more of those were resolved. He wasn't chasing after them anymore, like the dog chasing after its tail. And he wasn't renouncing them either. He was just resting as the entirety of the basic space of each of those points of view. He didn't need to do anything about them, not either indulge them or renounce them. He didn't need to discriminate about any point of view that appeared in any way at all. Yes, resting imperturbably, that is an incredible teaching. Now, does it mean that we don't do anything but sit under a tree and rest? No, because that isn't what the Buddha taught either. He said it doesn't matter whether you're sitting down, walking around, standing on your head, flying through space, whatever it is, rest imperturbably. However you go about your life, rest imperturbably. So you see, in this, nothing is excluded in resting imperturbably. Perhaps you've been sitting in meditation retreats where you've been watching your breath in one-pointed concentration, and now you can watch your breath in one-pointed concentration and rest imperturbably while doing so. There's nothing that needs to be excluded. And certainly, the result of any kind of meditation is meditative stability throughout day and night. That's the goal of all meditative practice. So that the practice isn't just on the cushion, it is pervasive, it's all pervasive, day and night. This is what meditation practices lead to. Now, the ultimate meditation, which is to rest imperturbably as awareness, guarantees this very swiftly because it doesn't split meditation out into just one part of the day. From the beginning, there's resting imperturbably for short moments repeated many times until it becomes spontaneous and automatic. And this resting imperturbably is entirely uncontrived. In other words, we're not trying to contrive a special time when we rest. We just rest in whatever way is easeful to us. Like some people just come here repeatedly, and that's all they do. They come here repeatedly. And just in this environment, more and more of the resting essence of awareness becomes obvious. Other people couple that with resting naturally. In other words, a point of view comes up, just like with the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. And when the point of view comes up, it's rest that is relied upon rather than chasing after the point of view and taking it to be something in its own right. when we do that, then we fatigue ourselves, just like the dog. Of course, the dog, when we fatigue ourselves, we get all frustrated, confused, and overwrought. Now, the dog who chases its tail, when it gives up, it's like, oh, what me worry, so what? You know, I'm chasing my tail for a while. Now I'm going to go do something else. But, you know, without thinking any of that. Now, so you see, dogs and other creatures, other animals other than humans, do not have self-knowing awareness. They only have spontaneous awareness. They have no capacity to self-reflect, to say, ah, yes, I'm only having a quarter of a cup of kibble today because I've been eating too much. Or, you know, so they don't have this capacity to self-reflect. They're entirely spontaneous, and they're incredible teachers. In terms of resting as awareness, they're great messengers of resting as awareness because they're completely spontaneous and free, totally at rest in relation to all experiences. You know, the tiger or leopard or whatever it is that's wandering around and has mauled a few people, this is a spontaneous expression. It isn't an expression of violence, and there's no forethought, oh, I'm going to get that juicy person over there and gobble them up. And then afterward, there's no regret, like, oh my God, what have I done? So, of course, we don't want to go around mauling people, of course. But, and this is the importance of wisdom. The human being has the capacity for wisdom, and this is what is talked about as Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the wisdom body. Buddha nature is the wisdom body of great benefit. The wisdom body of great benefit that is indivisible from the vast expanse that is beyond infinite space. And it is that wisdom body itself that emanates the body, speech, mind, qualities, and activities of a wisdom being, whether it's Buddha or any other being. These are not traits that are genetically endowed and then passed from one person to another. They're naturally present in everyone, no matter what one's DNA, so to speak, is. And so, you know, when we rest as awareness, we become familiar with this wisdom identity, this natural identity, this awakened nature, our true nature that is always present within ourselves. And this is really effortless. If you've learned that it's difficult, what you've learned is absolutely incorrect. It is not difficult. What already is present as our natural state couldn't possibly be difficult. And if the practical know-how is present in a teaching, accomplishment of it is very swift. And who's accomplishing what? Well, who cares? You know, just rest imperturbably, and you'll be more and more loving, wise, and filled with energy. To get into philosophical games and thinking about this, and what is this, and who did that, and who exists, and this, that, and the other thing, that's just another point of view. That's another point of view. All points of view are equal. It doesn't matter what they are. Just because we've learned that some points of view are positive and others are negative, and we have to get rid of the negative ones and only have the positive ones, that's just a belief system. It's a primitive belief system. It's really a primitive belief system about who we are as human beings, because beyond all that choosing between good and bad is the perfection of wisdom, perfect wisdom that doesn't choose between anything. It doesn't need to choose between anything in order to be. Do you see what I'm saying? It just is. And it doesn't require thinking about things. So just in the same way a puppy dog acts spontaneously, wisdom is a spontaneous responsiveness to whatever's occurring. It's a naturally occurring beneficial responsiveness to whatever is occurring. So this is what we want when we're trying to get more good points of view and have fewer bad points of view. This is what we're really looking for, isn't it? We really want to be beneficially responsive, and we want to be good people and live our lives in the best way possible. And the way to do that is not through sorting out the points of view. Through sorting out the points of view, maybe we can have some accomplishment in that regard by having more positive points of view. However, if what we want is wisdom, primordial wisdom, fundamental wisdom that is inseparable from the nature of everything, then definitely what we want to do is rest imperturbably and not be selecting all the time between all the points of view. That's a lot of hard work to be like the dog chasing its tail and constantly frustrated and confused with intermittent happiness. So there's happiness, and when we're living a life based on points of view, there may be happiness, and whenever we have that happiness, we think, I've got it. Now I've got my happiness. It's going to be this way from now on. However, it never is. The only inherent happiness there is the happiness that is beyond discriminating. Beyond discriminating between all the thoughts and all the emotions and what they mean and how we got them and how we're going to make them better, how we're going to get rid of the negative ones. Now here's another very important matter about these points of view. We cannot hold on to the ones we like, and we can't get rid of the ones we don't like. So it's totally fruitless. Why even go there? It's totally fruitless. All points of view, no matter what they are, because they have no independent nature, they're always resolving spontaneously in, of, as, and through the basic space of awareness. That's all that's ever occurring. They're the dynamic energy of awareness in the same way that a current in the ocean is dynamic energy of the ocean, so too all these points of view are the dynamic energy of awareness. And just like the current can't be separated out from the ocean, it'll remain water, always remain the water of the ocean, so too the dynamic energy of points of view, it has no independent existence of its own. And when we just rest imperturbably, we see that and we stop the grind. We stop the grind of working on all those points of view. It's a thankless task, I'll tell you. And most of us, we learn to do this. We learn to work on all our points of view. And so then when we hear about something as incredible as being an embodiment of timeless wisdom awareness, we think, wow, now I'm really going to have to work on my points of view. If I want that, I'm really going to have to work on my points of view. So what do? We go out and we find someone who agrees with us. We find someone who will say, yeah, you're right, you really do have to work on your points of view, and it might take many lifetimes for you to do that. So when we rest as awareness, we see that every point of view, no matter what it is, has an independent nature. There isn't a single point of view anywhere that has an independent nature. And this includes very big points of view that pervade entire cultures and worlds, like karma. Karma is a very pervasive point of view, and so is sin. Both of these are have no existence independent of awareness. There's never been an other within awareness, including any kind of law that somehow rules awareness. This has never been. And when we rest imperturbably, we see that this is so. All the highest teachings of Buddhism, Hinduism, all state the same thing, that there is no karma. So karma is a belief system, and when we believe in a point of view, then we believe in that point of view, and it looks, everything that we look at plays out according to that point of view. That's just the way it is. So if we believe in anything, whether it's karma or sin or climbing the corporate ladder or whatever it is, whatever we see is what we get, so to speak. So whatever points of view we're chasing around like the dog chasing its tail, then that's what we'll see everywhere we look. But when we rest imperturbably, we don't have to say, oh, I'm dashing every belief I've ever had. All we do is rest. When the belief comes up, we rest. And in our own experience, we see that all these points of view, no matter how dearly held they are by how many people, that they do lack an independent nature. They really do lack an independent nature. And this is true for all experience, no matter what it is. So if we're talking about sublime realizations or levels of consciousness or whatever it is, each of these is just a point of view. It's not a place to take up residence. No experience, no matter how sublime it is, has an independent nature. It's not some amazing thing to hold on to. If we try to hold on to it, then we'll never know that which is beyond all the different states of consciousness. It's awareness that is aware of consciousness. So we want to go to the root. Now, maybe sometimes in some traditions these two are used interchangeably, awareness and consciousness. But most often when consciousness is talked about, in the strictest sense, according to doctrine, consciousness is seen to be the underlying ground of phenomena or points of view or what goes on in the mind. However, there's never been an underlying ground other than awareness. There isn't like a middleman in between awareness and phenomena called consciousness. You see what I'm saying? So there is no... in an ultimate sense, there is no alaya, as it's called in Buddhism, or underlying, or consciousness, as it's sometimes called in Hinduism. But Hinduism also has the concept of ultimate consciousness, which could be likened to awareness. So it's important not to get fixed on anything. You can call it whatever you want, as long as you know what it is. Do you see what I'm saying? And you can rest as that. Rest imperturbably is that. It really doesn't matter what you call it. Just know that that which is the root of everything is that you want to get familiar with. You want to gain stability in that. And the best approach for doing that is to rest in that. To rest as that equanimity. To rest as that complete relief that is the essence of everything that appears. And in so doing, in an entirely uncontrived way, maybe the first day it might be for an instant that rest is obvious, and that'll grow longer and longer. The more the rest there is in an entirely uncontrived way, the more obvious it'll be at all times. So yeah, this is what we can count on. If we adopt points of view about who we are, then we'll spend a lot of our life just spinning around within the tail-chasing syndrome. Now, chasing the tail, it's an interesting illustration because it never leads anywhere. You know, it doesn't lead anywhere at all. In other words, there's no satisfaction and fulfillment in it other than the act itself, which is an act that says, I think I may be getting somewhere. But when we just give up and stop chasing after what lacks independent existence, then we really get in touch with ourselves. So this is important. I have a good friend who's a Tibetan Lama, and a high Tibetan Lama, although he'd never call himself that, of course. And you know, he's laughing all the time, filled with joy and super completeness. And he said, there are many sublime realizations along the way. Which is, you know, a way of saying these are all points of view. It's preposterous to hold on to anything. There are many sublime realizations along the way. But when we rest imperturbably, everything that appears is a sublime realization. Not just the states with fancy names like emptiness, non-appearances, no personal identity. Are there any other questions that anyone may have at this point? Alan?
Is it okay to say that mind is synonymous with awareness?
Yes, it is. As long as you're saying that mind is synonymous with awareness. Yeah. But you see, mind synonymous with awareness. Many people believe that mind is synonymous with thoughts, emotions, and experiences, and that thoughts, emotions, and experiences are what comprises mind. So you see, that is a grave error and a fatal misunderstanding if what we want is happiness. Because the mind is not comprised of thoughts, emotions, and experiences. It's comprised of awareness, as are all the thoughts, emotions, and experiences. We don't really use the term mind much in the Great Freedom Teaching. The kind of mind that is thought to be comprised of thoughts, emotions, and experiences is really just a point of view. It doesn't have an independent nature. Whatever's thinking in us is awareness. That's all that's thinking. So there would be no thinking without awareness. So awareness is always completely the superstructure of all thinking. There's nowhere to find awareness, because once we start to look for it, we're looking away from it. Do you see what I'm saying? We're saying, oh, it must be somewhere else other than right here, that which is thinking everything, that which is feeling everything, that which is sensing everything. It's impossible to get away from awareness.
Could we then say that the mind is like the current in the ocean, it's not separate from the ocean, that awareness is manifesting as the mind, or I guess what you just said, awareness is the mind.
Here we try to keep it as simple as possible, but without oversimplifying the nature of awareness, so that many people can understand the true nature of their being. in common terms and in straightforward language.
Is it true to say that the personal identity is like a collection of points of view that you've just kind of collected over your lifetime? Is that a way of looking at it?
Brilliant. Well, when we think we have a personal identity, then most of us think it's based on our thoughts, emotions, and experiences, that that's what our personal identity is. And because we believe we're ruled by the points of view of time and place, and also cause and effect, we think that all of the points of view we've had all of our lives comprise our personal identity. When we begin to rest as awareness and gain some stability in that, we can see more and more that our personal points of view aren't the only points of view appearing within awareness. They're all appearing within awareness. And with this comes about a naturally occurring compassion, a real warmth of compassion, because we see that there's never been a split anywhere. There's never been a division of any kind between us and anyone else. Now, those personal histories can be a real prison, huh? Yeah, whoa. And for some of us, in fact, for most of us, our personal histories are not something we even want to look at that much, you know. Or if we do look at them, we're only looking at the positive parts. So if we really look at the content of our points of view and taking ourselves to be those points of view, we can't help but have tremendous compassion for ourselves. In resting imperturbably, we see that taking ourselves to be all these points of view, it just leads to an inner war, a war within ourselves that then plays itself out in wars with others. So when we rest, we just become so compassionate in an uncontrived way, a way that we don't need to cultivate. And that naturally spills over onto everyone. We see everyone more and more through the eyes of love. It's a natural avenue of seeing, you know. It's only awareness that is seeing. So the more we rest as awareness, the more we see as awareness, which is synonymous with love, wisdom, and energy.